We do have bagels. We do have hot chocolate, coffee, if you did not know. It looks like most of you did. Ladies and gentlemen,
grand entrance.
We are going to go ahead and get started. My name's Mark Edwards. I think, as maybe most of you know, it's lovely to have you here on this January fresh morning. Happy New Year to you all. And the first thing I will say is that I didn't have anything to do with inviting Scott Harmon to speak to us all, although I'm quite glad that he's here. Jonathan Milley took the lead for the Youth Ministry Committee and wisely, in my view, asked Annalise Hume, who was here last week, and also wisely asked Scott Harmon. Jonathan was going to introduce Scott this morning, but has taken ill, so that has fallen to me. Jonathan's introduction, which I will also corroborate, would have noted Scott's long-term service on the Youth Ministry Committee, many years of teaching middle school, and by far having the most raucous and tricked-out van on our Appalachia Service Project trip. When the vans pull up at the first gas station, the first van opens the door and tired people spill out. The second van pulls up and tired people spill out. The third van pulls up and it's Scott's and loud music is blaring. The disco ball on the inside of the van is spinning. Tinsel is everywhere and the door opens and everybody comes bursting out, singing, dancing, screaming, laughing, who knows what. Jonathan was in part interested in Scott to present to us this morning because Jonathan has a military background and was a helicopter pilot and notes that that experience was pretty, helicopter mechanic and pilot, notes that that experience was pretty formative for his faith journey. And wanted to hear from Scott, too, who also has a military background on the bomb squad. So we're going to maybe hear a story or two from that. And I would just say that from my own experience, Scott has been a great and inspiring and always up for anything comrade in adventures. So we're delighted to have Scott and our Lord Jesus Christ to tell us how the two go together. So let's pray, and then we'll invite Scott up. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this lovely morning. We thank you for our friends. Thank you for the strange things that you do in our lives. And that as Scott's had the chance to look back on, and as we get a chance to hear about it, that you, the strange God, would emerge and teach us something about ourselves and you. And so thank you for this chance. We ask your time together in Christ's name. Amen. Ladies and gentlemen, Scott A. Harmon. Thank
you. Is that helpful? Good. Awesome. So before we get started, I don't know how many people were here when Dave Davis started? Were you here the first day? Do you remember his first sermon? Do you remember where he started his first sermon? He basically said, Princeton is an amazing town. Like, there's all these things to do. There's beautiful coffee shops and things. Thank you for being here. Like, that was his main message. Like, why I don't, people just kind of showed up. So I'm thankful to see everyone. I'm Scott Harmon, and I started with a couple of disclaimers. And the disclaimers are as follows. One of the things about me is that I don't let the facts stand in the way of a good story. And so with time and space and my willingness to bend facts to make up a good story, you should not treat any of this as factual. This is my remembrance bent to my reality for entertainment and presentation purposes. I am also not in any way, shape, or form an expert on faith, on belief, on church. I know that this community has an incredibly rich group of people who are very, very smart on matters like this, and I am not one of those people. And so you should probably ignore all of this if we're being completely honest. And finally, this is Lennon John's fault. So I think many of you know what happens when you put myself, and in many cases Alan, in front of a group of people and let us talk bad things. If bad things happen today, then I think we have Len and John to thank for that. The general story here is journeys in faith. And I will say that I was talking to Annalise, and Mark alluded to it earlier, that it has been a phenomenal exercise for me personally. It's a gift to be asked about your faith and to attempt to kind of write out how you came to believe the things that you have come to believe. And I think I would offer that taking a few minutes and putting pen to paper is just really a rich exercise, and it has been a beautiful experience for me, quite frankly. What I'm going to try to talk about today, and when I distilled it all down, and this literally was an insight that I had sitting on a plane late at night trying to kind of think through what this thing might look like, is that faith is a verb. And I know I was an engineer, and so a lot of people look at me and say, he doesn't know the English language, faith is obviously not a verb, but I think it is a verb, and it should be treated like a verb. You're going to hear things today that I have very, very substantial discomfort with a lot of things that we talk about when it comes to faith. And those discomforts for me resolve themselves when I treat faith like a verb. I think it was Plato who basically said, if you're going to tell somebody, then tell them what you're going to tell them, actually tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And so for me, that's what I think you're going to hear today, what I hope you'll hear in this story. I'm going to start with the deep background. So my dad grew up on a farm in Northwest Ohio. And when I say Northwest Ohio, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and I think on the East Coast we think that that's flyover terrain, right? Columbus is a city. And then you go northwest, and there's a smaller city called Toledo, which a lot of people would kind of argue maybe that's a city or not. And then you go kind of southwest a little bit, and you get to a town called Napoleon. And then you go out from there, and somewhere you find this thing called County Road P. They don't even name the roads out there. And my dad grew up on a farm on County Road P. And they went to this church, St. Paul's Lutheran Church. It is a Missouri Synod Lutheran church. And so in the overall scheme of things, Missouri Synod is a very, very conservative, very biblical, very the Bible is the Bible type of church. And I remember a conversation from my early years where we were having a conversation about the Bible and the world, and my dad basically said, yeah, the Bible is inerrant. And I said, well, so the world is only 6,000 years old? And he said, well, yes, of course. And I said, well, what about the dinosaur bones? Like, the dinosaur bones are like millions of years old. And he was like, not if God doesn't want them to be. And so, like, that's one half of kind of my faith lineage. My mom, some of you might actually recognize this church. This is Shadyside Presbyterian in Pittsburgh. And obviously there's a very deep integration between Nassau and kind of the Pittsburgh Presbyterian community. So my mother grew up in a family outside of Pittsburgh, and as they got older, we would occasionally go to church at Shadyside Presbyterian. Shadyside is a lot like Nassau, kind of a mainline PCUSA type church. And so that's the kind of background of my faith. A father who had a very, very conservative, very, very kind of rural, religious, what we would call evangelical Christian faith. And my mother, who went to a church that felt a lot more like what Nassau feels like. And they then took me to a place called Messiah Lutheran. And Messiah Lutheran is probably the absolute average of the two. It was a great place to be. It was fantastic. Still Lutheran, which as we know is a little bit more on the conservative side of things, but within the Lutheran Church, certainly not Missouri Synod. And so it felt like home to me. And one of the things the pastor said to me in confirmation is still something that stuck to me today. He said, you can't break the Ten Commandments. You can break yourself against the Ten Commandments. And that's an interesting, an interesting shift on things. It was a way of kind of breaking some of this conundrum between my father's very kind of religious, very rule-oriented faith and my mother's more, I would say, active. And so my mother was much more into some of the stuff that we consider to be mission work. And so when the Vietnam refugees came over, we took food and clothing and helped people move into shelter and things like that. And so This church was a great place for it. The other role model there was a woman named Marsha Blackburn, and Marsha Blackburn was the leader of the youth group, and she was the kindest, friendliest, most wonderful person. It didn't matter who you were as a kid, whether you were one of the hoodlums or one of the all-stars or whatever else, Marsha Blackburn had a place for you in her heart. And so these role models kind of evolved as different ways of experiencing and interpreting faith. And then they sent me to a Catholic school. So my mother perceived that I was too smart for my own good, and rather than going to the local public school, decided to send me off to a Catholic school. And this creates a completely new wrinkle, because as we all know, Catholics are slightly different from everything else that I've experienced. And when you're in a Catholic school, it's all day. I mean, we went to church, you know, we went to a Catholic service every single day. We had a Catholic education class every day. And so it was a very, very interesting time, because the best of the Catholic Church was on display at St. Charles. I had the most amazing experience there, even though I wasn't a Catholic. The education was outstanding, the teachers were incredible, the coaches were fantastic. It really was a beautiful place. And at the same time, all of these additional, to me, very strange belief structures were in play, and we're now part of this kind of stew of stuff that is working around in my head in terms of, what do you believe? What is your faith? And so this is me. This is how I would characterize my faith at about that point in time. It's basically just a riot. I don't have any clue. You've got all of these people who have different views, and we're all working from the same book, and we're all working from the same person, but the interpretations of that are really kind of oddly, strangely, confusingly different, at least for me. And so I went to some place that was a little bit more ordered. I went to a place called West Point. So lots of structure. This is a picture of the Cadet Chapel at West Point. Seems like the kind of place where you might be able to bring order to your faith. I will say that from my perspective, it's the complete opposite. You spend the day, I mean, I don't mean to put too fine a point on it, but at West Point, you're learning how to kill people. Like, that is the job. That is what the Army does. We can call it defense, but defense is a soft word for killing people. And the interrelationship between faith and that particular mission is a very, very complicated and fraught one, at least for me. I had a very, very difficult time with that, if I'm being honest. And Mark alluded to something pretty subtle, which I will highlight for you. Mark mentioned that I was a bomb disposal guy in the Army. And we graduate with about 1,000 people, and there are 4 people who go to bomb disposal school. I was one of 4 people out of 1,000. And the main reason that I did that is because I was having a very, very difficult time imagining myself as my job every day planning to shoot people. I really struggled with that. I spent a summer doing it, and it is not pleasant to contemplate, if I'm being honest. And bomb disposal, while it sounds very violent and very risky, and it is those things, is the opposite. The point of bomb disposal is to keep people from being killed, injured, all those kinds of things. And we have a peacetime mission, and so we support local law enforcement, we support the FBI and the Secret Service and things like that in an effort to prevent people from being injured. And that sounded like a place that was better for me, a place that was more consistent with my faith as I had come to understand it. So West Point was a weird time for me. I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't go to church much there. I did not feel very close to God at West Point, despite, I mean, there's enormously beautiful, like the Cadet Chapel at West Point is an extraordinarily beautiful place. I will say, I mean, it's funny because West Point, everybody's an engineer at West Point, and I find this comical, right? So that's the Cadet Chapel, right? You can kind of see it in the background and all these kind of landscapes of West Point. And that's where we live, kind of down. And I will just note that for those of you who are aspiring, I know we've got some youngsters, if you're an aspiring church designer, I'm going to recommend that you put the church a little closer to the people. And don't put it up a big, long hill, because there's just nobody in the world who wants to walk up a big, huge, long hill for half a mile to get to church in the morning. So just, you know, I don't know which engineers they used for that particular design decision. After we graduated, I got married to my lovely wife, who for some reason is here today. I think she'd rather be hiding someplace else, but she wanted me to show her the presentation, and I said no. So. So Good Shepherd Lutheran Church was a church on the outskirts of one of the military bases we were assigned to, and it was kind of my reintroduction into faith to a certain extent. There was this, you know, West Point was, if we're being honest, was a big desert of faith. It was not something I thought about very much there at all. And Good Shepherd was a cute little, I think it was Presbyterian, maybe Methodist? Oh, it's Lutheran, sorry. When everybody in the audience knows something you can't remember, yeah, right. And it was great. And it was the first time that we started to kind of get involved in the church. And so I taught middle school, Sunday school at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, and we were only there for a little while, but we had a great time. And it started to kind of renew and inform kind of what I wanted to be in church. And that active part of it was a component of it. And teaching was something I enjoyed a lot. Then went to Harvard Business School. And this is... This kind of cracks me. This is the 1957 chapel at Harvard Business School. Talk about too smart for their own good. That thing right there, that vertical thing, that's a clock. So, you know, like, I know, it's the strangest thing ever. They really, really love their design aesthetic. And if you're ever in Cambridge, you should check that place out. It's beautiful. They've got little koi ponds. And it's very quiet and very contemplative. It's a really nice place to spend a few minutes of quiet time. But it's not a church. And this is another place where I spent formative time in a place that has a very, very difficult relationship with faith, right? The Harvard of the time is definitely the Milton Friedman Harvard, which is, you know, companies have one objective, and that is to return value to their shareholders. That is the only thing companies do. Shareholder, just kick out profit, give it to shareholders. That is your one and only mission, right? And that's tough. That is a tough message to hear. That's not something that I have come to believe. It's not something I think is worthwhile for the way that we live or the world that we live in. And so so we explored some other churches. We actually had the opportunity. We saw Pastor Gomes at the Harvard Chapel a couple of times when he was kind of quite the thing. And so there were these kind of intermittent little spots where faith emerged. But in general, HBS was another kind of... a difficult time faith-wise, probably not helped by the fact that we had our first child and could barely get out of our own way. So by the time I graduated from HBS, like, I don't know what I think. I have absolutely no clue. If you would ask me to do this presentation then, I have no idea what I would have presented to you. Because between capitalism and the military and the Catholics and the, you know, evangelicals and the everybody else, And then there's Nassau One. So Nassau One is characterized by the fact that we had young children at the time. We had very young children at the time. And I think when you have young kids, wherever you are in your faith journey, there is something that draws you back to church. And we wanted to come back to church. And so we moved to Princeton. And we literally, this is a true story, we kind of lived not too far from where we live now. Actually, no, we lived in Greenview. Yeah, right. Lived by the cemetery, by Allen Cemetery. It's not really Allen Cemetery, I guess, but Allen's a person I associate with the cemetery. And we literally just worked our way down Nassau Street, and we went to each of the churches on Nassau Street and kind of figured out which one might work for us. And do you know the name of the woman who was the Sunday school teacher? There was this woman who was a force of nature. I think she was probably 80. Versus bliss. Oh. So I think she was probably 80. She used to go on these, like, she was still at 80 going on canoeing trips out into the, like, the kind of nowhere of Canada. And she just had this presence. And my oldest child walked into her Sunday school room class and didn't complain one bit, sat down, was doing crafts, and Nassau was our new home. And it was just as simple as that. And it was a beautiful thing, and I'm thankful for this day, because we went to a lot of churches and the kids are clawing at your legs and they don't want to be there and they want to go, but Carolyn, this was the place. And then things go a little bit sideways. So we moved here in the late, 1999, kind of early 2000. And I was working for a startup, and when the stock market is up and everything is great, startup life is amazing. Like, it's the most fantastic thing ever. You're paper millionaires, you're like 28. Like, it's the happiest thing in the world. And then it all goes very, very sadly. It all collapsed and you're unemployed and life is really quite unhappy because you have to pay the bills and you've got kids and everything is really, really quite ugly. And then this guy shows up. So anybody know who that guy is? Peter Henry, that's right, Peter Henry. So Peter at the time, I think was like the interim youth director. He was interim, he was only, I think, here for 1 year officially. Now, he was at the seminary, and so he was getting a PhD, so he was in the Nassau community for longer than that, but he was the interim youth director for 1 year. And, he's picking on the unemployed guy, so he basically is like, well, you're not doing anything, so maybe you could come on a mission trip this summer. And I was like, okay, like, I don't have anything else to do, as you noted, and that sounds interesting. And so I signed up for the mission trip, and I think that was the summer of 2002 is what I had kind of signed up for. This was probably March or April. And pretty soon after that, I got offered a job at a company, and Angie and I worked together for many years at Church & Dwight. And I had this moment of panic, because I got offered this job, and literally I'm going to ask for a vacation like 3 weeks later. Because I've signed up for this mission trip. And I'm a little bit freaked out by the whole thing because the last thing I want to do is for them to rescind an offer and go back to unemployment. And it was amazing. The guy who I was going to work with basically said, look, my sister did mission trips for her entire growing up and still does them. She's probably done 15 or 20 of them. And I'd be perfectly happy. It's no problem at all. And now things start resolving a little bit, right? Some of the early questions that John and Len sent were about, like, how do you reconcile business and faith? And I can't speak for every company, but Church & Dwight, in my experience, is a place where you can do that. It is a place that is run honorably. We have employee giving fund. They donate money. We spend a lot of money on local homeless initiatives, food initiatives, and things like that. It is a very, very human place where you can have a nice career, and you can live a faithful life, in my opinion. It's a great example of organization that's not run like Milton Friedman would run it, but is run with a little bit more holistic sense in the world. So off we go, and that's the first one, and I'm a little bit bummed, because in the era of digital, you can find pictures everywhere. It took us a little bit longer to find. We actually finally found a picture, but it was too late. But Evan Moorhead was on the first mission trip that I went on. It was to Virginia. And it was insane. It was absolutely insane. What Mark described about the van and the color and the action. The kids are young and they're enthusiastic, and it's the most amazing experience you could ever have, in my opinion. And so now things are starting to kind of feel right again. And from there, basically got involved with teaching with high school kids and the middle school kids. Keg Buttenheim and Patty Thiel and I taught for years upstairs. And the world is starting to come together. Work is good, life is good, church is good, and I found things that I can do, right? And I don't know, maybe this is good or maybe this is bad, but I'm a lot better when I can do things. And doing things with the youth group and doing the mission trips and doing teaching in Sunday school for me was very, very therapeutic. And about the time everything was looking fantastic, I decided to take a job up in Boston. And we moved to a town called Concord, Massachusetts, and it was very, very funny. So when we told people at Nassau that we were moving to Boston, they were like, oh, well, you're going to be a Congregational. And I didn't know what that was. I had no idea. I'd never heard. This is another faith thing that I was just completely ignorant of. So apparently, the Presbyterians took the South and the Congregationalists took the North. And so sure enough, we did kind of the same thing. We went to a bunch of different churches, some of which were quite interesting. We went to a Presbyterian church. It was not a PCUSA church. It was very interesting because the pastor in his little moment was talking about the fellowship hour afterwards, but basically said that the ladies will be over, in this room, and the gentlemen will be over in, this room doing something else, and we're thinking, okay, this is not the Presbyterian church that we know. So we finally found a Congregational church that fit us very, very nicely. We call it Nassau North, just in shorthand parlance. And pretty quickly, things go back to what I had done before. And so they had mission trips, and they had a very, very active youth program as well. And now we're in the age of digital cameras, so I can bring you some of the images. But this is from a reservation, an Indian reservation out west. So this group ranges a little bit, like they're not afraid to get on a plane. And so we put the kids on planes and then go places. But you're doing all the same things. And it was cold and miserable. But at the end of the day, you're out kind of in another culture, meeting people you would never otherwise meet, and helping kids see a vision of God and a vision of help and support for the communities they live in and for the broader community and learning more about the world. And this feels very, very right to me. And again, got, you know, started teaching again, all this other kind of stuff. Now, I will say that one thing about working with youth groups is that all kinds of weird things happen. And I don't know whether this is, I think I may have joined a gang in this photograph. I don't know what that little symbology that they're doing is. So you have to be careful when you're working with kids. But this was a trip to Jamaica. And so we went down to Catadupa. So everybody thinks Jamaica and the resorts and everything else like that. This was kind of in the interior of Jamaica. I mean, it was absolutely nowhere. And there was a school that they were working on, a new schoolhouse. So we're building walls for what are ultimately going to be another church or another room of the school as it expands. You get caught in the rain, you're dancing around. It's absolutely an extraordinary experience. And then, yeah, there's always lunacy and hilarity. And again, when we think about faith, to me, I don't get the self-punishment, self-flagellation, making things miserable for people. To me, the joy of this kind of work is a joy of faith. I know my life would be much poorer for it. And I think it's that kid in the kid in the red hat ended up dating my daughter. So that's another hazard of these kinds of events. So then we come back to Princeton. Obviously, I'm here, so we came back. So Nassau version 2, the kids are now older. And when the kids are young, you kind of want to go to church. When the kids are teenagers, you need to go to church just to survive. Like it becomes a survival influence. It's how you kind of, I don't know, protect yourself or something. So those three smiling children are my daughters who, you know, at that point are teenagers. And that guy shows up. And I know who that guy is, but this guy, this is one of my favorite stories. So probably 2.5 years after we moved back, Mark, you know, I've kind of met Mark and we're getting along and things like that. And he sends me a text message, "Hey, I'm trying to get in touch with Lauren, my middle daughter. You know, can you tell her, like, I want to talk to her?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure. Like, I don't know why she wouldn't write you back." So I called Lauren and I said, "Hey, Lauren, Mark's trying to get in touch with you. Like, can you call him back?" And Lauren says, "No." I'm like, why aren't you going to call Mark? And she says, "Every time I talk to that guy, he talks me into doing something I don't want to do." So, Mark Edwards in a nutshell. In my experience, you should just roll with it. He's going to get you one way or the other. And again, we're off to ASP again. So we're off to Appalachian Service Project. We've kind of settled on them as kind of a partner for our mission trips. It's amazing. Like, they're just a very, very well-organized group of people. They do great work. They keep the kids occupied. They've got great resources. I've got my partner in crime. There's always some hilarity. It's amazing. And you're out with kids, and you're working in a community. And look, we all know this, but the Appalachian community is, I mean, if we're being, not to make political, but this is Trump Central. And so these are people who believe very, very, very different things than what we believe. And the experience for me personally and for the kids of being down there and interacting with people who are very, very different is a beautiful thing. It is enlightening. It is faith growing. It's extraordinary. And we learn a few things. And this guy here on the bottom right of your screen. Sometimes you do these things and you actually never meet the person at the house that you're working on. Like, sometimes we just never meet the person. They're not there, or they're avoiding us or whatever else. This guy was the complete opposite. He was there every day. He was super, super funny, super, super friendly. And he said, "Look, on Wednesday, don't bring lunch. Usually we bring lunch. We kind of do peanut butter and jellies and we eat there." He said, "Don't bring lunch on Wednesday. I'll make lunch." And I'm freaking out because, like, you know, people are very, very poor. They don't have a lot of money for food and things like that. And we've got 8, 9, you know, people to feed. We show up, I don't know, probably 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and he's got the smoker going. And the smoker's been going for a few hours. And the smell that is coming out of that smoker will stop you in your tracks. I mean, it was amazing. And he rolls out a spread at lunchtime that is basically, you know, smoked pork shoulder, coleslaw, watermelon. I mean, if there was a barbecue restaurant in Princeton that could serve food of that quality, it would cost you hundreds of dollars. It was extraordinary. And he lays it all out. We have the most amazing meal, and I didn't put it in here, but we have a picture of everybody just passed out afterwards, like just laying on the ground because we're so completely sated. But that's part of the experience, right? The kindness of others. It's one thing to do kindness and to be kind to people. It's a completely different thing to receive kindness. And here was a man who did not have two nickels to rub together. And he showed us extraordinary kindness and was just a beautiful man. And then the strange tradition occurs where it seems like every time I do something with the youth, especially something a little extended, I'm going to get pied or caked or clobbered somehow. And so this is one of the occupational hazards as you contemplate whether you'd like to get involved. And then these two show up. So these two are in the audience today. This is Alan and Angie Olson, as you all know. And they call with this very innocent little, well, you know, we've been doing loaves and fishes for a while, and we're just wondering if maybe you might be interested in, like, you know, taking it over. And as we've kind of discovered, I will say yes to almost anything. And so I say yes. And the first meeting was amazing because Angie is a finance operations type person, and so she thinks an extraordinary organization in detail, and I do not. And she's running through all of the things, and I don't even know where this place is. I have no idea what we're talking about, and most of it is lost on me. And so I think they intended to throw it over the wall and have me, you know, catch it. That did not work out. They have continued to be super deeply involved, and the next thing you know, we're out working at St. Mary's, and I'm getting kind of more deeply involved in another kind of kindness, which is kind of feeding the hungry. And faith in action, faith as a verb, faith as doing something, is actually doing. And I will note that sometimes things do come around. And so, if you're gonna give me something that I have to do, then, you know, there may be consequences is all I will say about that. So, as you know, Alan has been an awesome partner. And then, everybody know this person? This is Kelsey Lambright. She did it to me, too. She said, look, we got to go to North Bay. Mark can't go. We need a grown-up. I don't know why she's looking at me as a grown-up. I don't know why she's looking at Mark as a grown-up. But, and the next thing you know, we're off to North Bay. And North Bay is a middle school experience. It's a very, very super fun thing. And you're off doing all kinds of crazy things. We've got scavenger hunts, just general hilarity, dragging kids on boats. And of course, I end up getting pied again, so that's just part of the lunacy. But this is a slightly different experience because it's actually run by an organization called Young Life. And I have some philosophical differences, some faith differences with Young Life. But one thing they do that's really, really amazing is that they really do believe that the way to faith for young kids is through doing things and enjoying things. You know what I mean? That it doesn't have to be just talk. Let's get out and have fun and let kids experience God through action and through faith and through having some fun. And so this was another kind of formative experience for me, a way of experiencing God and experiencing faith was very, very different from what I grew up with. And then that guy calls. You guys know Tom Charles? Japers. People have got to stop calling me. I need a new phone number or whatever. So Tom Charles, interestingly, so Evan and I, when we did those early mission trips, Tom Charles's daughter, two daughters, I think, yeah, were on those mission trips. And again, I don't know why people who kind of know me from mission trips think that I should be involved with, like, organized things. But I am now the Nassau Church representative to the Princeton Community Housing Organization. And For those who don't know Princeton Community Housing, it's an incredible, it's just a fantastic organization. And they basically develop and manage affordable housing here in Princeton. And they call it the PCH difference. But what they really, really work on is it's not just a home. They try to provide all of the other services that low-income people need to live, and to live with security and comfort and dignity and things like that. And so whether they need food support, whether they need job support, they give away scholarships. So kids who grew up in these communities win scholarships and go off to college and things like that. It's a beautiful, beautiful organization. Has been super, super fun. And there's the meeting to frivolity ratio is a little bit off for me. I like a little more frivolity and a little fewer meetings. But has been another really, really active part of my faith journey because, again, we're out doing things in the community. They're actually building on it. They just built an extension on onto Princeton Community Village. And so another 20 houses for people who can't afford to live in our community but now are able to do so. And then this guy's back again. So this is, I'm going to give you a little window into my soul that I'm maybe not very proud of. So I have a lovely wife, as you all know. I have three daughters who are pretty wonderful. My lovely wife and two of my daughters had been on this trip called Beyond Malibu, right? And Beyond Malibu is this hiking trip out in British Columbia, and it's pretty rigorous, you know what I mean? You're carrying all of your food, you're carrying your shelter with you, you're gone for a week. I mean, it's legit. And I kind of wanted to do it, but kind of didn't want to do it. I was, you know, the Army kind of ruined hiking for me. It wasn't fun anymore. And Mark knew that I was not thrilled about the idea of doing this, but he basically said, Allison did it. And I was like, yep. Lauren did it. Kate did it. He was kind of inferring that maybe I wasn't, you know, tough enough to do this trip. And so I said yes. And he also had promises. He said, you're going to see the most amazing, beautiful, like it's extraordinary. The physical beauty of that place is amazing. And you're going to be with these amazing people. Like, you know, the people who go on these trips are adventurous and wonderful. This is, I don't know if you guys know J.B. Wakefield, but that's J.B. Wakefield. That man is a saint because these trips are hard, and he took his two sons on that trip. And I will tell you, if my two kids had been on that trip with me, they would not have come back. J.B. Wakefield is an absolute saint. He said, you'll get these great pictures, you'll look very, very manly and all this other kind of stuff. And I'm like, fine. Like, you talked me into it again. I will say that this is basically how it all turned out. So I think that was day 5 of no shower, you know, all of the horror of the whole thing. Do not take selfies of yourself. And this is the first time it's been shown in public, so there's nobody, I'm going to move past that quickly. Yeah, I'm glad. And I wanted to come back. So this was an event that that Dave worked on with his kind of interfaith group. And so that's Rabbi Feldman, I think the late Rabbi Feldman, Pastor Davis, and Imam Shibli. And I don't know if any of you had a chance to go to that, but it was beautiful. It was absolutely extraordinary. And to me, an example of what we as a faith community should be doing is building ties, trying to get over our weddedness to what we believe. I think that's, in my opinion, it's a huge problem. And that's why I say, I think I am much more comfortable with faith as a verb than a belief structure. And one of the things that I remember from that presentation, and didn't happen here, they did 3 of them. They did 1 at the mosque, 1 at the synagogue, and 1 here. But at the one here, Dave recounted a story of what had happened at the mosque. And apparently one of the young people at the mosque asked Dave straight up, do you think I'm going to hell because I'm Muslim? And Dave, and again, I'm caveating this by saying my memory may not be perfect, and sometimes I bend the truth for a good story, but my recollection is that Dave said, no, I don't know how I could possibly condemn you for having a different faith, right? Oh, man. Like, when you think through the implications of that, if all faiths, you know, have truth, right? If all faiths are real, that starts to kind of blow your mind. And now I've got this riot in my head again about faith. What is faith? And for me, I completely agree with what Dave said. I don't know how on earth I could say that that somehow my religion is the revealed true religion and somebody else's is false and fake. I don't know the implications of that. And it's one of the things I struggle with when it comes to faith. But when I think of faith as a verb, these are the things that come to mind for me. It's about love your God. Love is an action word, right? Love is not sitting around. Love is not a feeling. Love is a doing. Love your neighbor. Do justice. Love kindness. Walk. Walk is not just walk, right? Walk is getting out into the world and doing things. Your kingdom come, right? It's not just sitting around out there. It's coming. Your will be done. Who's doing it? We're doing it, right? We're the ones. The Good Samaritan, which one of these was the one? The one who showed mercy, right? Showing it, doing it, living it. So, for me, faith is a verb. I don't understand all the different belief structures. I don't know how to reconcile the many things that I think I believe. But my faith becomes real when I'm out doing stuff with the kids, doing stuff with the community and things like that. And I am deeply, deeply, deeply grateful to this community for giving me the opportunity to do that in lots and lots of different ways. And I think that's it. And I didn't leave a lot of time for questions intentionally because I don't want to answer any questions. But anyway.
Thank you, Scott. And I'm going to just confess that I haven't cried that much since Adeline graduated kindergarten. I have a question for you. Looking back on your life, your earliest pictures growing up, you showed us like 6 pictures of churches.
Yeah.
No sports teams.
Yeah.
No first bikes. No first cars.
Yeah.
What about those things?
I played soccer in high school. I was, I can't tell that story. My wife knows what the story is. I was the really, really annoying golden child kid that everybody couldn't stand. I was the golden child kid in high school. Like, I was the kid who, National Honor Society, class officer, like, varsity letter, state championships, like, all that stuff. I was very annoying. That was me. I actually deleted the photograph. My kids make fun of me for my high school pictures, which are very, I had big blonde hair. I was all the very, very annoying things. So I was born overseas. My dad was an Air Force officer, so we kind of moved all around. So we lived in California, Ohio, Virginia, the UK, Germany, et cetera, et cetera.
And so looking back, did those play a role in your faith story, or is maybe?
I think the moving around does. I do think that moving around does. I think that you gain a sense of the fact that you can't just be an island, right? I think it's easy if you don't move. Now, there's other ways that you can experience. There's lots of other ways. But by moving, you're forced to kind of build connections and things like that. You're forced to kind of get out in the world and, to a certain extent, forced to adapt. We moved in one day. We woke up in Columbia, South Carolina, which at the time was arguing about the Confederate flag and whether a woman could go to the Citadel, right? Those are the debates they were having at that moment in time. We moved in one day to Cambridge, Massachusetts, right? That's a completely different world where you walk across the JFK Bridge and you might hear 20 languages being spoken. Yes, I think that moving around helps you adapt to different environments, which I think has some value.
Other questions?
And my first car was a Volkswagen Diesel Rabbit that had a 0-60 time of about 2 weeks.
Thank you, Scott, for sharing with us. I'm curious what brought you to West Point. And I know you described that it was a really challenging experience once you got there. So what took you there? And did you have an inkling ahead of time that maybe that was going to be a challenge for you?
That's such an interesting question. So the things that drew me there, the things I really liked about West Point from the outside were that it wasn't just academic. That every student there is an athlete. You play sports all the time. leadership is something that you do from the first day. The experience is about developing leadership. My dad was an Air Force guy. So I was thinking about college. I was thinking about all the academies. He said, look, the Navy is about ships. The Air Force is about planes. The Army is about people. And so the leadership part of it was always appealing to me. The morality piece, right? Like the code there had deep appeal to me. The idea of a principled set of rules to live by absolutely appealed to me. And then rigorous academic environment. So it was that group of things that really, really appealed to me. To be honest, I had no money. Like I don't know how I would have paid for college otherwise, which was an element too. I did not have an inkling is the short answer. I had no idea. It was all kind of remote and abstract until you've got a gun in your hand and you realize what you're up to. It's a very interesting question. Thank you. Oh, Evan.
I guess this is part of what Mark does, where he just puts you on the spot, right? I just sitting here like, why is the microphone in? What's changed for you from what differences have you noticed in terms of some of the trips you've gone? Because you and I went on a lot of trips together, starting back, I think, 2002, you said was our first one when Peter got you involved, and I got involved a couple years before that when Lisa. Yep. So there's always somebody behind it, right? Lisa gets, for me it was Lisa Hickman, Nichols Hickman.
Yep.
For you it was Peter Henry. But what's changed for you from that, kind of that first tour with NASA to the trips? What differences do you see in terms of working with the youth? I'm curious, because I was with you on those first trips, from kind of the early to mid-2000s, but now I haven't gone on any in a few years, so I'm curious what perspective. What's your perspective now on that on the faith with the youth and the high school group?
Right, I think I will answer. I think it's stunning how many things are the same. You know what I mean? The kids and the experience are in some ways just the same every time. But you got a bunch of kids who don't know each other, and you put them into a big group, and you ask them to do something kind for other people. And good things happen every time. To me, the thing that has probably changed is phones, right? Is that when we started these trips, kids didn't have phones. The internet was barely there. And that was great. It was fantastic. You didn't miss them. You didn't have them. Nobody knew what they were. Now, when we go on mission trips, Mark takes the phones, right? And so the kids experience this kind of like, what just happened? I don't have my phone to kind of be bored with. And I will say, I think it's super fun to watch them kind of rediscover each other and the fact that we can play games and we can have conversations and things like that. And it's kind of another sense of discovery that you could see. Some of you have taught before. To me, when you see a kid's eyes light up because they kind of feel something, they kind of learn something, that's a beautiful thing. And I think our kids kind of experience that each in their own way as they reconnect with each other and toss the phones out. So.
I think it's just a comment, but yeah. I think it really improves the experience. I think kids are yearning to say they don't have their phones. It puts them all on a level.
It puts all the kids on a level playing field, so nobody else, but I know that my daughters love the fact that their phones were taken away and were kind of rediscovering games, card games, all those things that you all would play. So yeah. I think it's a wonderful thing.
Now, I will say that they spend about a third of that time trying to prank you. And so that's been a little bit of a downside. But in general, I think that's one of the big things that's changed.
Evan, you should come with us.
Oh, I'm trying to recruit him. I was trying to recruit him this morning. So I'm not as effective as you are.
So you presented your autobiographical series of engagements with churches in a way that might seem like it was an unbroken chain. Mm. I'm wondering if there was a period in that span of time when this faith stuff no longer spoke to you or moved you the way it had, and if so, what prompted your re-engagement?
So West Point was clearly a big one. I don't think I went to church once when I was at West Point. And HBS was another one. I definitely did not go to church while we were there. And the re-engagement after West Point, after Kate and I got married, was probably to Kate's credit, if I'm being honest. Kate is my better angel in many ways. I think that it's easy when you're one person to kind of maybe not make the right choice. But when you have to look at eye to eye to your spouse, that's a different choice. And so I think I would have to give Kate credit for why we re-engaged after that. And after HBS, we moved here. And I really do think it was the kids who kind of brought us back. Faith meant something, the experience, the way we grew up and things like that. Kate's upbringing is kind of similar to mine. And I think we knew that when we had kids, we wanted to bring them to church. And so they were the driving force. And since then, it's been largely uninterrupted. So, yeah.
Other questions. Kate, do you have a question for Mr. Harmon?
She's just hoping I'll stop talking before I really embarrass myself or her.
Well, this is a short question. How did you meet Kate?
Do you know this story?
No.
Oh. Wow. Okay. Do people have time? Because this is not a short answer.
3 minutes.
All right, I'll try and do it in 3 minutes. All right, how did I meet Kate? Kate is my roommate from West Point's sister. So that is how we met. In full truth, I knew Kate's cookies before I knew Kate. Kate would send cookies with her brother, who was my roommate, and so we got our own special batch, and then she would make a batch for kind of everybody else, which was great. So I kind of knew I liked Kate. We met a couple of times, but we're in completely different places, you know, while I was at West Point. And then the spring after I graduated, I was in bomb disposal school, part of which is just south of D.C. Kate was in D.C., and my brother, now my brother-in-law, my roommate, got married. And so I was the best man. My wife was one of the bridesmaids. I mean, I was the most attractive best man, and so I attracted her attention. And we navigated at the end of the week that we would go on a date the next weekend because I was sad and lonely and had just moved to the area, and she was a D.C. veteran. And so her hook was, would you like to run the George Washington Parkway 15K, you know, next Sunday with me? And the answer to that question is not in any shape or form. Do I want to run the George Washington Parkway 15K? But you're beautiful, and I really like you, so I'm going to do this. So midweek we talk, and she says, well, why don't you come on Saturday, and we'll go down to the University of Virginia. There's this steeplechase called Fox Field. And I was like, all right, two-day date. This is looking better and better. Like, I'm feeling good. So I show up very, very early Saturday morning. She serves me blueberries and eggs, which I don't like either of those things. So it's not getting off to a good start. We go to Fox Field, where basically I'm interrogated all day by her college friends. And they ply me with liquor and food, and they pull all my secrets out of me. So I'm literally, they didn't get a rubber hose out, but it was practically that experience. We drank all day. We come back, my roommate wants to go out to Fuddruckers for dinner. I don't know if you've been to Fuddruckers. This is not a good pre-race meal. Not high quality, but we went to Fuddruckers. We had that new relationship energy, so we were up until like 3 o'clock in the morning, you know how that is, right? Just talking and talking, it was great and amazing. We got up at 5:30 in the morning to drive all the way out to Mount Vernon or something. They have just paved the George Washington Parkway, so it is black as night, and the sun is beating down. It's at least 500 degrees on this thing, and it's 15 kilometers, that's almost 10 miles. It is horrible, just oozing all of the horrible things that I had consumed the day before. It is absolutely, I've rarely been as unhappy, except when I'm with Mark sometimes, specifically on that stupid mountain in British Columbia. But anyway, it was miserable. By the end of it, I am ready to die. And she says, oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm moving today. Can you help me move? Like, did it. My story. See, I've got the mic at this point, so I'm on a roll. Fourth floor apartment, furniture, bed, mattresses, up, down, all day. This, again, think about everything else that's happened. Up, down, up, down, up, down into the new place. Like, it's now 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I've study hall, so we have tests every day at Bond Disposal School, so I gotta go study. And she says, you know, why don't we have dinner with my parents? And, you know, so we went and had dinner with my future wife's parents. So that was our first date. Our second date, we're in D.C., and it's kind of like Saturday about lunchtime, and there's soccer moms in minivans everywhere, right? And I look at this person who I'm now on a second date with, and I said, you know, when we have kids, we're not getting a minivan. And so I'd gotten engaged, married, and had kids with this person that I was on a second date with, and that is the story of how I met my wife. Probably went over the 3-minute limit a little bit, but yes.
Thank you, Kate. Last chance for questions. Well, one last one.
One last one.
Scott, what do you do for a living now? Oh. And how does this experience affect your job?
So I still work for Church & Dwight, I lead our sales team. We sell to retailers, so we sell our product to companies like Walmart and Target and things like that. And I lead the team that sells to Target, and so I spend a lot of time kind of going back and forth to Minneapolis. And in my opinion, commerce is commerce, right? And in the broad outlines, capitalism is good for the world. At the end of the day, the discoveries, the things that we make as a result of the profit motive are still better than the way the world was in the absence of that, right? You can go to a communist culture and that world is not nearly as good. And so the broad outlines of capitalism, I agree with. And to me, the question is, how do you balance that against the needs of the community and the needs of employees and things like that? And to me, one of the things I like about Church & Dwight a lot is that the working environment is very human. The work-life balance is very, very reasonable. The way that we do business is high integrity, and we make investments as individuals and as a company in our communities, both in terms of projects and actions and actually getting people outside the building, but also in terms of monetary donations and things like that. And so to me, if you're gonna engage in the world of capitalism, Church & Dwight's a pretty good place to do it. Thanks for asking, because work can be distracting from faith for sure, and I have not found that to be the case, to be honest with you.
Lord Jesus, we thank you for Scott A. Harmon and that spirit. We thank you for his family. Thank you that he is a friend and a guide and just a member of your church together with us all. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Scott Harmon.
Thank you, Mark.